Let me say again, thanks for coming. I should have said earlier, my name's Steve. I'm one of the leaders of Rylands Community Church, and it's really great that you've come to be here. We hope this will be a useful evening, really, as we think about this particular question, the Bible, a dangerous fairy tale. We are conscious that there are loads of other questions that people have, and that's partly why we've got the yellow paper. And if you think this goes well and we want to do it again, then whichever the most popular question is, then we could have another go at doing that, doing a talk on that maybe in a few months' time. But as we think about this question, a Bible, a dangerous fairy tale, I wonder what you talked about around your tables. I used to work with university students down in Cambridge, and this sort of objection would often come up. And it was normally that people would say something like, well, the Bible is kind of like, it's like a fairy tale. It's the kind of story that people tell themselves to make themselves feel better, because they can't cope with, you know, the brokenness or the disappointment of the world. And so we have this story, this happy ending, so to speak, that makes ourselves feel better. So people like writer John Gray, who some of you might have come across, wrote a book where he basically says, look, people just need to grow up, like become adults, stop being kids, and recognize that the world is broken. Stop telling yourself these stories. But if it's not a fairy tale, then for other people, it's a dangerous book, and I think increasingly so. Lots of people, maybe some of you this evening, think of the Bible as a regressive text, something that's going to take us back to the 1950s. And so taking the Bible seriously is a bit like going to your GP and seeing on their desk a textbook on medicine from the 1700s. And you kind of think, I want to make excuses. I don't want a GP that's looking at that. And at best, you make excuses. At worst, you report them to the General Medical Council. You avoid such people like that in life, don't we? And can I say, from the outside, I really do get those objections. But what I want to suggest is, as you sort of step inside Christianity for a moment, and that's kind of what I want to do this evening, that the view is a little bit different. As I said, I used to live down in Cambridge, and if you've been to Cambridge, you'll know that it's a beautiful city, but a small city, given its reputation across the world. But for me, the best parts of it wasn't the big, impressive buildings like King's College or Queen's College. It was the other little colleges that were scattered around the city that you can visit if you visit the city. You'd be walking down a crowded, noisy, tourist sort of filled street, and you would see this sort of brown, grey, imposing door in an archway, which didn't look very enticing at all. But you step through that door, and what you find is that the noise just stops as the door closes. And you find yourself in this beautiful, pristine, kind of manicured lawn, and often really quite big, sort of the size of half a football pitch, some of them. Or for others, you step through the door and you find yourself drawn towards a well-designed and beautiful garden that you're able to sit in and enjoy for a Sunday, sunny afternoon. And I guess my point there is, what I want to do tonight is, the Bible is this big, grey, imposing door with people have right objections. But when you step inside and you look around, often you'll be surprised, I think, what you find there. But it is a big sticking point. I read a few newspaper articles preparing for tonight and came across people saying things like this. One, a journalist said this. The sooner that we accept that these holy books, and he's talking particularly about the Bible, he says, the sooner that we accept that these holy books are nothing more than man-made pamphlets and are not in any way, shape or form divinely inspired or co-authored, the better. Another said this, that people take this stuff seriously in the 21st century is truly staggering. I may only listen to Christians and their churches after they scrap the Bible. And while you might be more polite in the way that you express your objection, I suspect for some of us, that sentiment sort of sits behind the objection, the Bible, a dangerous fairy tale, that to take the Bible seriously is actually to ditch your brain, to live in the light of a fairy tale. It's to regress into a bygone era of society that we've moved on from, both scientifically or indeed socially and culturally. But what often surprises me and I don't know if this might describe you, is that people that make this objection, when pressed, have actually rarely read the Bible thoughtfully for themselves. They might know a few sort of key stories that they find objectionable, but they've never really examined the evidence. They've never stepped through the grey-brown door, for want of another phrase. So Anne Rice, who some of you might know, wrote the book An Interview with a Vampire. After 30 years of being a devout and outspoken atheist, moved away from atheism and became a Christian, and she said this about the arguments that stopped her from embracing Christianity. She writes this: I saw that some arguments were no more than assumptions piled on assumptions. Conclusions were reached on the basis of little or no data at all. The whole case for the non-divine Jesus who stumbled into Jerusalem and somehow got crucified. That whole picture which floated around the liberal circles I often frequented as an atheist for 30 years, that case simply wasn't made. Not only was it not made, I discovered in this field some of the worst and most biased scholarship that I've ever read. See, as she stepped through the door and had a look around for herself, she discovered that far from being a hodgepodge of myths pulled together over many centuries, there are actually good reasons for taking the Bible seriously. From a historical point of view, just to take the New Testament as an example, the New Testament Gospels particularly, it might surprise you to know that there is way more historical data for the historicity of the New Testament Gospels than pretty much any other type or any other piece of ancient literature. So take, for example, Plato, writing in 427 to 324 BC. Most people would say that the writings of Plato are writings that we can know and we trust that he wrote them. But when you look at the data, what you find is that the earliest copy of the manuscript copy of his writings is about AD 900. So 1200 years after he lived, moved and had his being, so to speak. And that's similarly the case for other important documents. There's huge gaps of time between where we discover the first manuscript, whether Plato, Caesar, Homer in the Iliad, or Tacitus, or others. And of those copies that have been discovered by archaeologists, there's for Plato particularly, there are only 10 copies of his writings. But that's enough for those scholars to say, yep, we can be sure this is what Plato wrote, and so if you've read philosophy, you'll have read some Plato probably in your degree. So what? How do the New Testament Gospels compare to people like Plato and Caesar and Homer and others? Well, they were written, it's claimed, between AD 50 and AD 95. And we do have copies of those manuscripts, much like Plato. But we don't just have 10 copies. In the Greek language alone, there are probably close to about 4,000 manuscripts that have been dug up by archaeologists and discovered. You may remember the Dead Sea Scrolls being discovered in the 1940s and 50s, for those of you who are interested, and a lot of those manuscripts were found then. When you add in not just the Greek sort of manuscript copies, but the Bible or the New Testament Gospels were then translated because people were so passionate about it. It was translated into many other ancient languages. It gets up to something like, well, at least 20,000 copies that we have access to that we can compare and look at. And so be pretty confident that what we have in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John really wrote. And it's not hundreds and hundreds of years from when those copies are discovered from when they were first written. So you can go to the British Library in London, and you can look at the John Rylands copy. I don't think it's anything to do with Beeston Rylands, but John Rylands discovered a copy of John's Gospel, or a fragment of John's Gospel, which is dated as AD 110, which is a conservative estimate. It's only 25 years after John first penned his Gospel. So we're not talking hundreds of years, we're talking decades. Such that you can be confident that when you read Luke's Gospel, or John's Gospel, or Mark's Gospel, then there are good reasons to think that's what Mark, John, Luke, etc. wrote. Now, I'm not saying you would therefore be persuaded by the content of what they wrote, but that they wrote it is, you can trust it. It's not church leaders 300 years later making it up. It's real. It's them writing. So the texts themselves are reliable. But what about their claims that they make? Can we trust their claims? Well, lots of people would say that you examine historical documents by looking at, you know, what details do they include? Like, how can you be sure that it's sort of reliable history? And when you do those tests on the Gospels, what you find is, again, something quite surprising. So there's four things very briefly I want to point you to. First is that they're full of details that only eyewitnesses would have spoken about. And often those details, as archaeology continues its work, are corroborated by the things that archaeologists discover. Things like Luke knows where sycamore trees grow in Judah, or the layout of a particular town or city, or who the political leaders are. Details that he'd have no idea about if he was writing several hundred years later. So C.S. Lewis, the famous Oxford scholar who spent his life studying ancient myths, says that they're just too detailed accounts to be in the same category as those ancient legends and myths. He writes this. He says, "I've been reading poems, romances, visioned literature, legends and myths all my life. I know what they're like, and I know none of them are like this." So that's the first thing. They're too detailed to be put in the category of legend or myth evolving over time or written way later. You could ask questions about that later if you want to. But second point I want to make is that the distance from the time of the events to them being written down is really short. So take that John's Gospel, for example. That's 25 years after the ink dried on John's original page. Which means, if you think about it, that the stories that John is writing about are being circulated during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses that he's talking about. Which, if you're making something up, is very hard to persuade people of its reality if it can be undermined by the people that lived in the town at the particular time. So one writer says this, for a highly altered, fictionalized account of an event to take hold in the public imagination, it is necessary that the eyewitnesses and their children and their grandchildren all be long dead. They must be off the scene so that they cannot contradict or debunk the embellishments and falsehoods of the story. So remember that the gospel writers are writing about extraordinary events. People being raised from the dead, blind people seeing, paralyzed people walking. And more than that, they're naming those people. Luke particularly names those people. But he's never contradicted in history. Like, people oppose the Christians, that's true, and we'll think about that in a minute. But the events themselves, by others, become widely accepted and believed, which is extraordinary given that the protagonists and the antagonists of the stories are alive as those stories are circulating. Third, they wrote about things that make no sense if you were wanting to make it up. What I mean by that is that they don't flatter themselves. A case in point, if you were inventing a religion that you wanted to overthrow the Roman government with and persuade Jewish people to follow, then it would be a really surprising thing for the disciples to have made up the message that Jesus, the central to their message was that Jesus died on a Roman cross. For the Jewish people of that day, the cross was a sign that they were cursed by God, that they are under his judgment. For the Romans, the cross was a despicable way to die. It was a punishment that wasn't fit for Roman citizens, so Roman citizens wouldn't be crucified. So, like the modern day equivalent, if I can put it like this, imagine writing a glowing reference for someone, and in writing the glowing reference, you point to their life sentence in prison as evidence of their good moral character. You just wouldn't do that. And so it's extraordinary that if they're making it up, that was a bizarre thing for the disciples to do. And fourthly, one of the sad things about Roman culture in the first century, then the disappointing things, is that in a court of law, a woman's testimony is invalid. So you wouldn't be drawn to that. So you wouldn't, if you were making something up, that would be a bizarre thing to choose. But in the New Testament, the three most important moments in the life of Jesus, are the first witnesses of those moments are all women. So Mary, the mother of Jesus, to Jesus' birth and his incarnation. She's an unmarried, probably Jewish teenager. When Jesus dies on the cross, there are a number of women who are present, and they're highlighted as they're the ones who are being there when all the men, true to form, have scattered and fled and disappeared and are off the scene. At Jesus' resurrection, it's women who testify first. See, you just, again, if you were trying to fabricate something, you just wouldn't do that if you wanted to persuade your culture. So can I gently say that the objection that Ryland, people that go to Ryland's Community Church are enjoying fairy tales and dismissing and dumping our brains, well, when it comes to the New Testament Gospels, it just doesn't stack up with the evidence that you've got access to as much as we have. This is just out there kind of data that you can investigate for yourself. So that's the fairy tale side. What about that it's regressive or dangerous for us? Well, my first response would be this. Let's not assume that us in 2018 know what's best. Let me put it like this, quoting another writer. He says, one problem with some texts might be based on an unexamined belief in the superiority of our historical moment over other historical moments. We must not universalize our time any more than we should universalize our culture. To reject the Bible as regressive is to assume that you have now arrived at the ultimate historical moment from which all that is regressive and progressive can be discerned. But that belief is surely as narrow and as exclusive as the views in the Bible that you regard as offensive. See the point he's making? Why assume that we've got it right and that we're better than any culture past or any culture in the future? Like some of you here this evening, I grew up in the generation we grew up watching Friends and The Simpsons and not doing our schoolwork. But you'll know that if you've been paying attention to the news recently, that Friends and The Simpsons have both come under sharp criticism for misogyny, homophobia and racism. One person in a BBC article wrote this: I was just watching the Friends male nanny episode of Ross, about Ross, and it is so rude and homophobic, I hate him. More recently, The Simpsons is now to be considered, or one character, I should say, in The Simpsons, as propagating sort of racist stereotypes. Now, my point is, that might be right. Like, my point is not that we should all enjoy Friends and The Simpsons. Like, don't mishear me. My point is, though, that what we laughed at 20 years ago in my generation, and in fact applauded, and it got the best ratings, is something that we're now ashamed of. And so there's every reason to think that our grandchildren might just be appalled at some of the things that we laugh at. We mustn't think that we've arrived. And so it'd be narrow and exclusive of us to dismiss another historical claim or culture because of our own moment in history. That would be narrow and exclusive. More than that, though, if it's true, just for a second, if you could imagine that it's true what the Bible says about God and Jesus and humanity and all the things that Christians would teach, if that's true that there's a God who made us and who has things to say about what it means to be a human, I think you'd expect that to be challenging. Whether that is challenging for the writers of Friends in the 90s or the cultural sort of speakers of our own day, that this God might challenge cultures is not surprising to us. It shouldn't be surprising. It wouldn't be surprising, would it? That he would challenge cultures in all times. And if you know anything of the story of Christianity of the last 2,000 years, you'll know that that's what Christianity tends to do. It challenges cultures and civilizations. In our own civilization, it was Christianity and belief in the dignity of humanity that led to the abolition of the slave trade, driven by Wilberforce and others. We should expect that if God's there, that he would challenge us. And we should expect that of things like what we believe about important things, that to be challenged. So when Katie confronts me about something I'm doing, Katie's my wife, for those of you who don't know. Now, I might not like it, I might even find it painful to be exposed by something that I'm doing and to be challenged by her. But listening to her and seeking appropriate change enables our marriage, I hope, to flourish. To respond otherwise would be harmful to our marriage, to throw my toys out the pram or to get grumpy or to dismiss her challenge would well, our marriage wouldn't go well, would it? And when it comes to the objections, the cultural objections that we have to the Bible, the irony, I think, is that most of the things that we find objectionable were objectionable to the culture in which the Bible was written. So if you know anything about history, you'll know that the Romans persecuted the Christians for at least 300 years because it undermined Roman culture. It's not that the Bible was a part of Roman culture and we're trying to get back to Rome. No, it's always countercultural. It's always calling cultures to change and be transformed, to challenge and rebuke and correct. See, the Bible, I think, will always challenge you. You'll always find it difficult because it seeks to confront us on the big issues of life. The big questions like, what is life all about? Why is happiness so elusive? Why is there so much evil and violence? What is a human being for? How do human beings flourish? Those really important questions are the kind of questions the Bible is seeking to address and answer. And so going towards those questions, I think, would make anybody feel vulnerable to be challenged on those fundamental things about what makes us live in society in the way that we do. But also it's challenging, especially when you read that Jesus himself says that on all of those questions, that the answers to those questions in some way orbit him and center on him and who he is. That this one person out of 60 billion people who have lived on this planet should make the claims that he makes. Well, that's a huge deal. And when that one person out of 60 billion people has the kind of impact that Jesus of Nazareth has had, this peasant carpenter from Palestine, the kind of impact he's had for 2,000 years that has transformed cultures and changed and got rid of slavery and all sorts of other things, then I would say that when you come across someone like that, that person's probably worth exploring more about, paying attention to. See, that's the claim of the Bible, is it centers on this person, Jesus, that he makes God known to us, if you like. Shows us that there's a God who's really there and a God that we ignore and dismiss, but yet a God that, despite our turning away from him, still invites us to know him, to find meaning in knowing him, purpose and identity in the world that he's made. More than that, to be given life forever in his new creation instead of being lost forever without him. That's the big central claim that the Bible makes. If you like, the Bible is, the claim is that God has written himself into the pages of our own history, which is why the history is so important. And can I say, as a church, we think that's really exciting. It's a really exciting claim to explore and think about, rather than just be dismissed as fairy stories, given what I've already said. See, through the dark grey door of the Bible, I hope I've slightly persuaded you in some sense that behind the brown grey door, the big opposing grey door of the Bible, that there might just be something good, something beautiful and something true to explore, to play around in, to think about. Now, so this evening is the start of a conversation. And so we want you to talk about what I've spoken about around your tables. What struck you by what I said? What are the natural kind of objections that come out of what I've said? Or if there are other questions that you want to address, we'll do that after we've eaten our food together. But talk together. Don't be afraid of Fred talking about Brexit. And use the opportunity to chat about these things, and do that in a friendly and helpful way. Thanks for listening.